independently on each member firm at least once a year to subject its books to a surprise inspection. Ira Haupt & Company had filled out its most recent questionnaire early in October, and since the huge build-up in Allied's commodities position with Haupt took place after that, the questionnaire showed nothing amiss. As for the surprise inspection, the exchange's man was in the Haupt offices conducting it at the very time the trouble broke. The auditor had been there for a week, his nose buried in Haupt's account books. But the task of conducting such an inspection is a tedious one, and by November 19th, the auditor hadn't got around to examining the Haupt Commodities Department. They had set our man up with a desk in a department where nothing unusual was going on, an exchange official has since said. It's easy to say now that he should have smelled trouble, but he didn't. At mid-morning on Tuesday the 19th, Coyle and Bishop sat down with Kamerman to see what needed to be done about Haupt's problem and what could be done. Bishop remembers that the atmosphere of the meeting was by no means grim. According to Kamerman's figures, the amount of capital that Haupt needed to bring it up to snuff was about $180,000, an almost paltry sum for a firm of Haupt's size. Haupt could make up the deficiency either by obtaining new money from outside or by converting securities it owned into cash. Bishop urged the latter course as the quicker and surer, whereupon Kamerman telephoned his firm and instructed his partners to begin selling some of their securities at once. The difficulty, apparently, was going to be solved as simply as that. But during the rest of the day after Kamerman had left Leavenwall, the crisis showed a tendency to go through the process that in political circles had come to be called escalation. In the late afternoon, an ominous piece of news arrived. Allied had just filed a voluntary bankruptcy petition in Newark. Theoretically, the bankruptcy did not affect the financial position of its former brokers, since they held security for the money they had supplied Allied with. Nevertheless, the news was alarming in that it provided a hint of worse news to follow. Such news, indeed, was not long in coming. The same evening, word reached the stock exchange that the managers of the New York Produce Exchange, in an effort to forestall chaos in their market, had voted to suspend all trading in cottonseed oil futures until further notice, and to require immediate settlement of all outstanding contracts at a price dictated by them. Since the dictated price would have to be a low one, this meant that any remaining chance that Haupt or Williston and Bean had of getting out from under the Allied speculations on favorable terms was gone. In the member firm's department that evening, Bishop was frantically trying to get in touch with G. Keith Funston, the president of the stock exchange, who was first at a Midtown dinner and then on a train bound for Washington, where he was scheduled to testify the next day before a congressional committee. What with one thing and another, Bishop was busy in his office all evening. Toward midnight, he found himself the last man in the member firm's department and, having decided it was too late to go home to Fanwood, New Jersey for the night, he collapsed on a leather couch in Coyle's office. He had a restless night there. The cleaning women were considerably quiet, he said afterward, but the phones kept ringing all night long. Promptly at 9:30 on Wednesday morning, the Stock Exchange's Board of Governors met in the sixth-floor governor's room, which, with its regal red carpet, fierce old portraits, and fluted gilt columns, carries rather uncomfortable connotations of Wall Street's checkered past, and, in accordance with exchange regulations, voted to suspend Haupt and Willison and Bean because of their capital difficulties. The suspension was made public a few minutes after trading opened at 10 o'clock by Henry M. Watts, Jr., chairman of the Board of Governors, who ascended a rostrum that overlooks the trading floor, rang the bell that normally signals the beginning or ending of a day's trading, and read an announcement of it. From the point of view of the public, the immediate effect of the action was that the accounts of the almost 30,000 customers of the two suspended firms were now frozen. That is, the owners of the accounts could neither sell their stocks nor get their money out. Touched by the plight of these unfortunates, the stock exchange brass now set about trying to help the beleaguered firms raise enough capital to lift the suspensions and free the accounts. In the case of Williston and Bean, its efforts were triumphantly successful. It developed that this firm needed about $500,000 to get back into business, and so many fellow brokers came forward to help out with loans that the firm actually had to fight off unwanted offers. The $500,000 was finally accepted, partly from Walston and Company, and partly from Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner, and Smith. Cozily, the Bean of Williston and Bean was the very man who had been the caboose when the firm's name was Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner, and Bean. Restored to financial health by this timely injection of capital, Williston and Bean was relieved of its suspension, and its 9,000 customers were relieved of their anxiety, just after noon on Friday, or slightly more than 2 days after the suspension had been imposed. But in the case of Haupt, things went differently. It was clear by Wednesday that the capital shortage figure of $180,000 had been the rosiest of dreams. Even so, it appeared that the firm might still be solvent despite its losses on the forced sale of the oil contracts, on one condition. The condition was that the oil in Bayonne tanks that Allied had pledged to Haupt as collateral, and that now, through Allied's default, belonged to Haupt, could be sold to other oil processors at a fair price. Richard M. Crooks, an exchange governor who, unlike nearly all his colleagues, was an expert on commodities trading, figured that if the Bayonne oil were thus unloaded, Haupt might still end up slightly in the black. He therefore telephoned a couple of the country's leading vegetable oil processors and urged them to bid on the oil. The replies he received were unanimous and startling. The leading processors declined to make any bid at all, and they left Crooks with a feeling that they were suspicious of the Bayonne warehouse receipts held by Haupt, that they suspected some or all of them to be forgeries. If these suspicions were well-founded, it would follow that some or all of the oil attested to by the receipts was not in Bayonne. The situation was very simple, Crooks has said. Warehouse receipts are accepted in the commodities business as practically as good as currency, and now the possibility had been raised that millions of dollars of Haupt's assets consisted of counterfeit money. Still, all that Crooks knew definitely on Wednesday morning was that the processors would not bid on Allied oil. And throughout the rest of Wednesday and all day Thursday, the exchange furiously went on trying to help Haupt get back on its feet, along with Williston and Bean. Needless to say, the 15 partners of Haupt were busy at the same endeavor. And in aid of it, Kamerman told the Times buoyantly on Wednesday evening, "Ira Haupt and Company is solvent and is in an excellent financial position." Also on Wednesday evening, Crooks had dinner in New York with a veteran commodities broker from Chicago. "Although I'm an optimist by temperament, my experience tells me that these things always turn out to be much worse than they look at first," Crooks said recently. "I mentioned this to my broker friend, and he agreed. The next morning at about 11:30, he called me and said, 'Dick, this thing is 100% worse than even you think.'" A bit later, at midday on Thursday, the exchange's member firm's department learned that many of Allied's warehouse receipts were indeed fake. As nearly as can be determined, the Haupt partners were making the same unhappy discovery at about the same time. At any rate, a number of them did not go home Thursday evening, but spent the night at their offices, at 111 Broadway, trying to figure out what their position was. Bishop got home to Fanwood that night, but he found that he could sleep hardly any better there than on Coyle's couch. Accordingly, he rose before dawn, took the Jersey Central's 5-8 to the city, and, on a hunch, went to the Haupt offices. There, in the partners' area, recently redecorated with modern contour chairs, marble-topped filing cabinets, and refrigerators disguised as desks, he found several of the partners, unshaven and unkempt, drowsing in their chairs. "They were pretty shot by then," Bishop said later. "And no wonder. After being awakened, they told him that they had been up all night calculating, and that at about 3 o'clock they had come to the conclusion that their position was hopeless." In view of the worthlessness of the warehouse receipts, the Haupt firm was insolvent. Bishop took this disastrous intelligence with him to the stock exchange, or he waited for the sun to come up and for everyone else to come to work. At 1:40 on Friday afternoon, when the stock market was already badly rattled by the rumors of Hupp's impending failure, the first reports of the president's assassination reached the exchange floor, in garbled form. Crooks, who was there, says that the first thing he heard was that the president had been shot. The second was that the president's brother, the attorney general, had also been shot, and the third was that the vice president had had a heart attack. The rumors came like machine gun bullets, Crook says, and they struck with comparable impact. In the next 27 minutes, during which no hard news arrived to relieve the atmosphere of the apocalypse, the prices of stocks declined at a rate unparalleled in the exchange's history. In less than half an hour, the values of listed stocks decreased by $13 billion, and they would no doubt have dropped further if the Board of Governors had not closed the market for the day at 2:07. The panic's immediate effect on the Hupp situation was to make the status of the 20,000 frozen accounts far worse, because now, in the event of Hupp's bankruptcy and the consequent liquidation of many of the accounts, the cashing in would have to be done at panic prices, with heavy losses to the account's owners. A larger and less calculable effect of the events in Dallas was paralyzing despair. However, Wall Street, or rather some Wall Streeters, had a psychological advantage over the rest of the country in that there was work at hand to be done. This convergence of disasters confronted them with a definable task. Having testified in Washington on Wednesday afternoon, Funston had returned to New York that evening, and had spent most of Thursday as well as Friday morning working on getting Williston and Bean back in business. Sometime during that period, as was gradually made clear that Hupp was not merely short of capital but actually insolvent, Funston became convinced the exchange and its member firms must consider doing something virtually unprecedented, that is, reimburse the innocent victims of Hupp's imprudence with their own money. The nearest thing to a precedent for such action was the case of DuPont, Holmesy & Company, a small stock exchange firm that went bankrupt in 1960 as a result of fraud by one of its partners. The exchange then repaid the firm's customers the money they had been divested of, about $800,000. Now, having hurried back to his office from a lunch date, shortly before the emergency closing of the market, Funston set about putting his plan into action, calling about 30 leading brokers whose offices happened to be nearby and asking them to trot over to the exchange immediately as an unofficial delegation representing its membership. Shortly after 3 o'clock, the brokers were assembled in the South Committee Room, a somewhat smaller version of the governor's room, and Funston set before them the facts of the Hupp case as he then knew them, along with an outline of his plan for a solution. The facts were these. Hupp owed about $36 million to a group of United States and British banks. Since over $20 million of its assets were represented by warehouse receipts that now appeared to be worthless, there was no hope that Hupp could pay its debts. In the normal course of events, therefore, Hupp would be sued by the creditor banks when the courts reopened next week. The cash and many of the securities held by Hupp for its customers would be tied up by the creditors, and according to Funston's liberal estimate, some of the customers might end up getting back, after an extended period caused by legal delays, no more than 65 cents on the dollar. And there was another side to the case. If Hupp were to go into bankruptcy, the psychological effect of this, combined with the palpable effect of Hupp's considerable assets being thrown on the market, might well lead to further depression of a stock market already in wild retreat at a time of grave national crisis. Not only the welfare of the Hupp customer was at stake then, but perhaps the national welfare too. Funston's plan, simple enough in outline, was that the stock exchange, or its members, put up enough money to enable all the Hupp customers to get back their cash and securities, to be once again whole in the banking expression. The banking expression is etymologically sound. Whole derives from the Anglo-Saxon hal, which meant uninjured or recovered from injury, and from which hale is also derived. Funston further proposed that Hope's creditors, the banks, be persuaded to defer any efforts to collect their money until the customers had been taken care of. Funston estimated that the amount needed to do the job might run to $7 million, or even more. Almost to a man, the assembled brokers agreed to support this public-spirited, if not downright eleemosynary plan. But before the meeting was over, a difficulty arose. Now that the stock exchange and the member firms had decided on a deed of self-sacrifice, the problem confronting each side, to a certain extent anyway, was how to arrange to have the other side do the sacrificing. Funston urged the member firms to take over the entire matter. The firms declined the suggestion with thanks, and countered by urging the stock exchange to handle it. "If we do," Funston said, "you'll have to repay us the amount we pay out." Out of this not very dignified dialogue emerged an agreement that initially the funds would come out of the exchange's treasury, with repayment to be apportioned among the member firms later. A three-man committee, headed by Funston, was empowered to conduct negotiations to bring the deal off. The chief parties that needed negotiating with were Hupp's creditor banks. Their unanimous consent to the plan was essential, because if even one of them insisted on immediate liquidation of its loans, the pot would fall in, as the exchange's chairman, Henry Watts, a fatherly-looking graduate of Harvard and of Omaha Beach, 1944, pungently put it. Prominent among the creditors were four local banks of towering prestige: Chase Manhattan, Morgan Guaranty Trust, First National City, and Manufacturers Hanover Trust, which among them had lent Haupt about $18.5 million. Three of the banks have remained notably reticent about the exact amount of their ill-fated loans to Haupt, but blaming them for their silence would be like blaming a poker player who was less than garrulous about a losing night. The Chase, however, has said that Haupt owed it $5,700,000. Earlier in the week, George Champion, chairman of the Chase, had telephoned Funston. Not only did the stock exchange have a friend at Chase, Champion assured him, but the bank stood ready to give any help it could in the Haupt matter. Funston now called Champion and said he was ready to take him up on his offer. He and Bishop then began to try to assemble representatives of the Chase and the three other banks for an immediate conference. Bishop remembers that he felt highly bearish about the chances of rounding up a group of bankers at 5 o'clock on a Friday, even such an exceptional Friday as this one. But to his surprise, he found practically all of them at their battle stations and willing to come straight to the exchange. Funston and his fellow negotiators for the exchange, Chairman Watts and Vice Chairman Walter N. Frank, conferred with the bankers from shortly after 5 until well into the dinner hour. The meeting was constructive, if tense. "First, we all agreed that it was a devil of a situation all around," Funston subsequently recalled. "Then we got down to business. The bankers, of course, were hoping that the exchange would pick up the whole thing, but we quickly disabused them of that notion. Instead, I made them an offer. We would put up a certain sum in cash, solely for the benefit of the Haupt customers. In exchange for every dollar that we put up, the banks would defer collection, that is, would temporarily refrain from foreclosing on $2. If, as we then estimated, $22.5 million was needed to make Haupt solvent, we would put up $7.5 million, and the banks would defer collection of $15 million. They weren't so sure about our figures. They thought we were too low, and they insisted that the exchange's claim to get back any of its contribution out of Haupt assets would have to come after the bank's claims for their loans. We agreed to that. We all fought and negotiated, and when we finally went home, there was general agreement on the broad outline of the thing. Of course, everyone recognized that this meeting was only preliminary. To begin with, by no means all the creditor banks were represented at it, and that both the detail work and much of the hard bargaining would have to be done over the weekend. Just how much detail work and hard bargaining lay ahead became manifest on Saturday. The exchange's board met at 11, and more than two-thirds of its 33 members were present. Because of the Haupt crisis, some governors had canceled weekend plans, and others had flown in from their regular stands in such outposts as Georgia and Florida. The board's first action, a decision to keep the exchange closed on Monday, the day of the president's funeral, was accomplished with deep relief, because the holiday would give the negotiators an additional 24 hours in which to hammer out a deal before the deadline represented by the reopening of the courts and the markets. Funston brought the governors up to date on what was known about Haupt's financial position and on the status of the negotiations that had been begun with the banks. He also gave them a new estimate of the sum that might be required to make the Haupt customers whole, $9 million. After a fractional moment of silence, several governors rose to say, in essence, that they felt that more than money was at stake. It was a question of the relation of the stock exchange to the country's many million investors. The meeting was then temporarily adjourned, and, with the authority of the governor's lofty sentiments to back it up, the exchange's three-man committee got down to negotiations with the bankers. Thus, the pattern for Saturday and Sunday was set. While the rest of the nation sat stupefied in front of its television sets, and while the downtown Manhattan streets were as deserted as they must have been during the yellow fever epidemics of the early 19th century, the sixth floor of 11 Wall Street was a nexus of utterly absorbed activity. The exchange's committee would remain closeted with the bankers until a point was reached at which Funston and his colleagues needed further authorization. Then the Board of Governors would go into session again and either grant the new authority or decline to do so. Between sessions, the governors congregated in the hallways or smoked and brooded in empty offices. An ordinarily obscure corner of the exchange bureaucracy called the Conduct and Complaints Department was having a busy weekend, too. A staff of half a dozen there was continuously on the phone, dealing with anxious inquiries from Haupt customers, who were feeling anything but hail. And, of course, there were lawyers everywhere. "I never saw so many lawyers in my life," one veteran stock exchange man has said. Coyle estimates that there were more than 100 people at 11 Wall Street during most of the weekend, and since practically all local restaurants, as well as the exchange's own eating facilities, were closed, the food problem was acute. On Saturday, the entire output of a downtown lunch counter that had shrewdly stayed open was bought up and consumed, after which a taxi was dispatched to Greenwich Village for more supplies. On Sunday, one of the exchange secretaries thoughtfully brought in an electric coffee maker and a huge bag of groceries and set up shop in the chairman's dining room. The bankers' negotiating committee now included men from two Haupt creditors that had not been represented on Friday, the National State Bank of Newark and the Continental Illinois National Bank and Trust Company of Chicago. Still unrepresented were the four British creditors, Henry Ansbacher and Company, William Brandt's Sons and Company, Limited, S. Jaffet and Company, Limited, and Kleinwort Benson, Limited. Moreover, with the weekend half gone, they seemed to be temporarily unrepresentable. It was decided to continue negotiating without the British banks and then, on Monday morning, present any agreement to them for approval. A crucial point at issue, it now developed, was the amount of cash that would be needed from the stock exchange to fulfill its part of the bargain. The bankers accepted Funston's formula, under which they would defer collection of $2 for every dollar that the exchange contributed to the cause, and they did not doubt that Haupt was stuck with about $22.5 million worth of useless warehouse receipts. However, they were unwilling to take that figure as the maximum amount that might be necessary to liquidate Haupt. To be on the safe side, they argued, the amount ought to be based on Haupt's overall indebtedness to them, $36 million. And this meant that the exchange's cash contribution would have to be not $7.5 million, but $12. Another point at issue was the question of to whom the exchange would pay whatever sum was agreed upon. Some of the bankers thought the money ought to go straight into the coffers of Ira Haupt & Company, to be dispensed by the firm itself to its customers. The trouble with this suggestion, as the exchange's representatives were not slow to point out, was that it would put the exchange's contribution entirely beyond its control. As a final complication, one bank, the Continental Illinois, was distinctly reluctant to enter into the deal at all. The Continental's people were thinking in terms of their bank's exposure, an exchange man has explained sympathetically. They thought our arrangement might ultimately be more damaging to them than a formal Haupt bankruptcy and receivership. They needed time to consider, to make sure they were taking the proper action. But I must say they were cooperative. Indeed, since it was primarily the stock exchange's good name that was at the center of the planned deal, it would appear that all the banks were marvels of cooperation. After all, a banker is legally and morally charged with doing the best he can for his depositors and stockholders, and is therefore hardly in a position to indulge in grand gestures for the public good. If his eyes are flinty, they may mask a kind but stifled heart. As for the Continental, it had reason to be particularly slow to act, because its exposure amounted to well over $10 million, or much more than that of any other bank. No one concerned has been willing to say exactly what the points were on which the Continental held out, but it seems safe to assume that no bank or person who had lent Haupt less than $10 million can know exactly how the Continental felt. By the time the negotiations were recessed at about 6 o'clock Saturday evening, a compromise had been reached on the main issues, on the amount of cash controversy, by an agreement that the exchange would put up an initial $7.5 million, with a pledge to go up to $12 million if it became necessary, and on the controversy about how the money would be paid to the Haupt customers, by agreement that the exchange's chief examiner would be appointed liquidator of Haupt. But the Continental was still recalcitrant, and of course, the British banks had not yet even been approached. In any event, everybody shut up shop for the night, with pledges to return early the next afternoon, even though it was Sunday. Funston, who was coming down with a bad cold, went home to Greenwich. The bankers went home to places like Glen Cove and Basking Ridge. Watts, a diehard commuter from Philadelphia, went home to that tranquil city. Even Bishop went home to Fanwood. At 2 o'clock Sunday afternoon, the exchange governors, their ranks now augmented by rivals from Los Angeles, Minneapolis, Pittsburgh, and Richmond, met in joint session with the 30 representatives of member firms, who were anxious to learn what they were being committed to. After the current status of the emerging agreement had been explained to them, they voted unanimously in favor of going ahead with it. As the afternoon progressed, even Continental Illinois softened its opposition, and at about 6 o'clock, after a series of frantic long-distance telephone calls and attempts to track down Continental officers on trains and in airports, the Chicago Bank agreed to go along, explaining that it was doing so in the public interest rather than in pursuance of its officers' best business judgment. At about the same time, the Times financial editor, Thomas E. Mullaney, who, like the rest of the press, had been rigidly excluded from the sixth floor throughout the negotiations, called Funston to say he had heard rumors of a plan on Haupt in the offing. Because the British banks would have reason to be miffed, at the very least, if they should read in the next morning's air editions of a scheme to dispose of their credits without their agreement or even their knowledge, Funston had to give a reply that could only depress still further the spirits of the waiting 20,000 customers. "There is no plan," he said. The question of who would undertake the delicate task of cajoling the British banks had come up early Sunday afternoon. Funston, despite his cold, was anxious to make the trip. For one thing, he has since admitted, the drama of it appealed to him, and had gone as far as getting a secretary to reserve space on a plane. But as the afternoon progressed and the local problems continued to appear intractable, it was decided that he couldn't be spared. Several other governors quickly volunteered to go, and one of them, Gustav L. Levy, was eventually selected, on the ground that his firm, Goldman Sachs and Company, had had a long and close association with Kleinwort Benson, one of the British banks, and that Levy himself was on excellent terms with some of the Kleinwort Benson partners. Levy would later succeed Watts as chairman. Accordingly, Levy, accompanied by an executive and a lawyer of the Chase, who were presumably included in the hope that they would set the British banks an inspiring example of cooperation, left 11 Wall Street shortly after 5 o'clock and caught a London-bound jet at 7. The trio sat up on the plane most of the night, carefully planning the approach they would make to the bankers in the morning. They were well advised to do so, because the British banks certainly had no cause to feel cooperative. Their stock exchange wasn't in trouble. And there was more to it than that. According to unimpeachable sources, the four British banks had lent Haupt a total of $5.5 million, and these loans, like many short-term loans made by foreign banks to American brokers, had not been secured by any collateral. Sources only fractionally more impeachable maintain that some of the loans had been extended very recently, that is, a week or less before the debacle. The money lent is known to have consisted of euro dollars, a phantom but nonetheless serviceable currency consisting of dollar deposits in European banks. Some 4 billion euro dollars were actively traded among European financial institutions at that time, and the banks that lent the 5.5 million to Haupt had first borrowed them from somebody else. According to a local expert in international banking, euro dollars are customarily traded in huge blocks at a relatively tiny profit. For instance, a bank might borrow a block at 4.25% and lend it at 4.5%, at a net advantage of 0.25% per annum. Obviously, such transactions are looked upon as practically without risk. 0.25% of $5.5 million over a period of 1 week amounts to $264.42, which gives some indication of the size of the profit on the Haupt deal that the four British banks would have been able to divide among themselves, less expenses, if everything had gone as planned. Instead, they now stood to lose the whole bundle. Levy and the Chasemen arrived red-eyed in London shortly after daybreak on a depressingly drizzly morning. They went to the Savoy to change their clothes and have breakfast, and then headed straight for the city, London's financial district. Their first meeting was at the Fenchurch Street establishment of William Brandt's Sons, which had put up over half of the $5.5 million. The Brandt partners courteously offered condolences on the death of the president, and the Americans agreed that it was a terrible thing, whereupon both sides came to the point. The Brandt men knew of Haupt's impending failure, but not of the plan now afoot to rescue the Haupt customers by avoiding a formal bankruptcy. Levy explained this, and an hour's discussion followed, in the course of which the Britons showed a certain reluctance to go along, as well they might. Having just been taken in by one group of Yankees, they were not anxious to be immediately taken in by another. "They were very unhappy," Levy says. "They raised hell with me as a representative of the New York Stock Exchange, one of whose members had got them into this jam. They wanted to make a trade with us, to get a priority in the collection of their claims in exchange for coming along with us in agreeing to defer a collection. But their trading position wasn't really good. In a bankruptcy proceeding, their claims, based on unsecured loans, would have been considered after the claims of creditors who held collateral, and in my opinion, they would have never collected a nickel. On the other hand, under the terms of our offer, they would be treated equally with all the other Haupt creditors except the customers. We had to explain to them that we weren't trading." The Brandt men replied that before deciding, they wanted to think the matter over, and also to hear what the other British banks said. The American delegates then repaired to the London office of the Chase on Lombard Street, where by pre-arrangement they met with representatives of the three other British banks, and Levy had a chance for a reunion with his Kleinwort Benson friends. The circumstances of the reunion were obviously less than happy, but Levy says that his friends took a realistic view of their situation and, with heroic objectivity, actually helped their fellow Britons to see the American side of the question. Nevertheless, this meeting, like the earlier one, broke up without commitment by anyone. Levy and his colleagues stayed at the Chase for lunch and then walked over to the Bank of England, which was interested in the Haupt loans to the extent that their default would affect Britain's balance of payments. The Bank of England, through one of its deputies, assured the visitors of its distress over both America's national tragedy and Wall Street's parochial one, and advised them that while it lacked the power to tell the London banks what to do, in its judgment they would be wise to go along with the American scheme. Then, at about 2 o'clock, the trio returned to Lombard Street to wait nervously for word from the banks. As it happened, a parallel vigil was then beginning on Wall Street, where it was 9 o'clock on Monday morning, and where Funston, just arrived in his office and very much aware that only one day remained in which to get the deal wrapped up, was pacing his rug as he waited for a call that would tell him whether London was going to cause the pot to fall in. Kleinwort Benson and S. Chaffett and Company were the first to agree to go along, Levy recalls. Then, after a silence of perhaps half an hour, during which Levy and his colleagues began to have an agonizing sense of the minutes ticking away in New York, an affirmative answer came from Brandt. That was the big one. With the chief creditor and two of the three others in line, it was all but certain that Ansbacher would join up. At around 4 p.m. London time, Ansbacher did, and Levy was finally able to place the call that Funston had been waiting for. Their mission accomplished, the Americans went straight to the London airport, and within 3 hours were on a plane headed home. On getting the good news, Funston felt that the whole agreement was pretty well in the bag at last, since all that was needed to seal the bag was the signatures of the 15 Hauptgeneral partners, who seemed to have nothing to lose and everything to gain from the plan. Still, the task of getting those signatures was a vital one. Short of a bankruptcy suit, which everyone was trying to avoid, no liquidator could distribute the Haupt assets, not even the marble-topped cabinets and the refrigerators, without the partners' permission. Accordingly, late on Monday afternoon, the Haupt partners, each accompanied by his lawyer, trooped into Chairman Watt's office at the Stock Exchange to learn exactly what fate the Wall Street powers had been arranging for them. The Haupt partners could hardly have found the projected agreement pleasant reading, inasmuch as it prescribed, among other things, that they were to execute powers of attorney, giving a liquidator full control over Haupt's affairs. However, one of their own lawyers gave them a short, pungent talk, pointing out that they were personally liable for the firm's debts, whether or not they signed the agreement, so they might as well be public-spirited and sign it. More briefly, they were over a barrel. Many of them later filed personal bankruptcy papers. One startling event broke the even tenor of this gloomy meeting. Shortly after the Haupt lawyer had wound up his disquisition on the facts of life, someone noticed an unfamiliar and strikingly youthful face in the crowd and asked its owner to identify himself. The unhesitating reply was, "I'm Russell Watson, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal." There was a short, stunned silence, in recognition of the fact that an untimely leak might still disturb the delicate balance of money and emotion that made up the agreement. Watson himself, who was 24 and had been on the Journal for a year, has since explained how he got into the meeting and under what circumstances he left it. "I was new on the Stock Exchange beat then," he said afterward. "Earlier in the day, there had been word that Funston would probably hold a press conference sometime that evening. So I went over to the exchange. At the main entrance, I asked a guard where Mr. Funston's conference was. The guard said it was on the 6th floor and ushered me into an elevator. I suppose he thought I was a banker, a Haupt partner, or a lawyer. On the 6th floor, people were milling around everywhere. I just walked off the elevator and into the office where the meeting was. Nobody stopped me. I didn't understand much of what was going on. I got the feeling that whatever was at stake, there was general agreement, but still a lot of haggling over details to be done. I didn't recognize anybody there but Funston. I stood around quietly for about 5 minutes before anybody noticed me, and then everybody said pretty much at once, 'Good God, get out of here!' They didn't exactly kick me out, but I saw it was time to go." During the haggling phase that followed, a painfully protracted one it developed, the Haupt partners and their lawyers made a command post of Watt's office, while the bank representatives and their lawyers camped in the North Committee Room, just down the hall. Funston, who was determined that news of a settlement should be in the hands of investors before the opening of the market next morning, was going wild with irritation and frustration, and in an effort to speed things up, he constituted himself a sort of combination messenger boy and envoy. All Monday evening, I kept running back and forth saying, "Look, they won't give in on this point, so you've got to," he recalls. Or I'd say, "Look, what time it is, only 12 hours until tomorrow's market opening, initial here." At 15 minutes past midnight, 9 3/4 hours before the market's reopening, the agreement was signed in the South Committee Room by the 28 parties at interest, in an atmosphere that a participant has described as one of exhaustion and general relief. As soon as the banks opened on Tuesday morning, the stock exchange deposited $7.5 million, a sum amounting to roughly 1/3 of its available reserve, in an account on which the Haupt liquidator could draw. The same morning, the liquidator himself, James P. Mahoney, a veteran member of the exchange's staff, moved into the Haupt offices to take charge. The stock market, encouraged by confidence in the new president, or by news of the Haupt settlement, or by combination of the two, had its greatest one-day rise in history, more than eliminating Friday's losses. A week later, on December 2nd, Mahoney announced that $1,750,000 had already been paid out of the stock exchange account to bail out Haupt customers. By December 12th, the figure was up to $5,400,000, and by Christmas, to $6,700,000. Finally, on March 11th, 1964, the exchange was able to report that it had dispensed $9.5 million, and that the Haupt customers, with the exception of a handful who couldn't be found, were whole again. The agreement, in which some people saw an unmistakable implication that Wall Street's establishment now felt accountable for public harm caused by the misdeeds or even the misfortunes of any of its members, gave rise to a variety of reactions. The rescued Haupt customers were predictably grateful, of course. The Times said that the agreement was evidence of a sense of responsibility that served to inspire investor confidence and may have helped to avoid a potential panic. In Washington, President Johnson interrupted his first business day in office to telephone Funston and congratulate him. The chairman of the SEC, William L. Carey, who was not ordinarily given to throwing bouquets at the stock exchange, said in December that it had furnished a dramatic, impressive demonstration of its strength and concern for the public interest. Other stock exchanges around the world were silent on the matter, but if one may judge by the unsentimental way that most of them do business, some of their officials must have been indulging in a certain amount of head-shaking over the strange doings in New York. The stock exchange's member firms, who were assessed for the $9.5 million over a period of 3 years, appeared to be generally satisfied, although a few of them were heard to grumble that fine old firms with justified reputations for skill and probity should not be asked to pay the losses of greedy upstarts who overstep and get caught out. Oddly, almost no one seems to have expressed gratitude to the British and American banks, which recouped something like half of their losses. It may be that people simply don't thank banks, except in television commercials. The stock exchange itself, meanwhile, was torn between blushingly accepting congratulations and prudently, if perhaps gracelessly, insisting that what it had done wasn't to be regarded as a precedent, that it wouldn't necessarily do the same thing again. Nor were the exchange's officials at all sure that the same thing would have been done if the Haupt case had occurred earlier, even a very little earlier. Crooks, who was chairman of the exchange in the early 1950s, felt that the chances of such action during his term would have been about 50-50. Funston, who assumed his office in 1951, felt that the matter would have been questionable during the early years of his incumbency. "One's idea of public responsibility is evolutionary," he said. He was particularly annoyed by the idea, which he had heard repeatedly, that the exchange had acted out of a sense of guilt. Psychoanalytic interpretations of the event, he felt, were gratuitous, not to say churlish. As for those older governors who glared, quite possibly balefully, at the negotiations from their gilt frames in the governor's room and the North and South committee rooms, their reaction to the whole proceeding may be imagined, but cannot be known. Chapter 7 The Impacted Philosophers. Among the greatest problems facing American industry today, one may learn by talking with any of a large number of industrialists who are not known to be especially given to pontificating, is the problem of communication. This preoccupation with the difficulty of getting a thought out of one head and into another is something the industrialists share with a substantial number of intellectuals and creative writers, more and more of whom seem inclined to regard communication, or the lack of it, as one of the greatest problems not just of industry, but of humanity. A group of avant-garde writers and artists have given the importance of communication a backhanded boost by flatly and unequivocally proclaiming themselves to be against it. As far as the industrialists are concerned, I admit that in the course of hearing them invoke the word communication, often in an almost mystical way, over a period of years, I've had a lot of trouble figuring out exactly what they meant. The general thesis is clear enough, namely that everything would be all right, first, if they could get through to each other within their own organizations, and second, if they or their organizations could get through to everybody else. What has puzzled me is how and why, in this day when the foundations sponsor one study of communication after another, individuals and organizations fail so consistently to express themselves understandably, or how and why their listeners fail to grasp what they hear. A few years ago, I acquired a 2-volume publication of the United States Government Printing Office entitled Hearings Before the Subcommittee on Antitrust and Monopoly of the Committee on the Judiciary, United States Senate, 87th Congress, First Session, pursuant to Senate Resolution 52. And after a fairly diligent perusal of its 1,459 pages, I thought I could begin to see what the industrialists are talking about. The hearings, conducted in April, May, and June 1961, under the chairmanship of Senator Estes Kefauver of Tennessee, had to do with the now famous price-fixing and bid-rigging conspiracies in the electrical manufacturing industry, which had already resulted, the previous February, in the imposition by a federal judge in Philadelphia of fines totaling $1,924,500 on 29 firms and 45 of their employees, and also of 30-day prison sentences on 7 of the employees. Since there had been no public presentation of evidence, all the defendants having pleaded either guilty or no defense, and since the records of the grand juries that indicted them were secret, the public had had little opportunity to hear about the details of the violations, and Senator Kefauver felt that the whole matter needed a good airing. The transcript shows that it got one, and what the airing revealed, at least within the biggest company involved, was a breakdown in intramural communication so drastic as to make the building of the Tower of Babel seem a triumph of organizational rapport. In a series of indictments brought by the government in the United States District Court in Philadelphia between February and October 1960, the 29 companies and their executives were charged with having repeatedly violated Section 1 of the Sherman Act of 1890, which declares illegal every contract, combination in the form of trust or otherwise, or conspiracy, in restraint of trade or commerce among the several states or with foreign nations. The Sherman Act was the instrument used in the celebrated trust-busting activities of Theodore Roosevelt, and along with the Clayton Act of 1914, it has served as the government's weapon against cartels and monopolies ever since. The violations, the government alleged, were committed in connection with the sale of large and expensive pieces of apparatus of a variety that is required chiefly by public and private electric utility companies. Power transformers, switchgear assemblies, and turbine generator units, among many others. And were the outcome of a series of meetings attended by executives of the supposedly competing companies, beginning at least as early as 1956, and continuing into 1959, at which non-competitive price levels were agreed upon, nominally sealed bids on individual contracts were rigged in advance, and each company was allocated a certain percentage of the available business. The government further alleged that, in an effort to preserve the secrecy of these meetings, the executives had resorted to such devices as referring to their companies by code numbers in their correspondence, making telephone calls from public booths or from their homes rather than from their offices, and doctoring the expense accounts covering their get-togethers to conceal the fact that they had all been in a certain city on a certain day. But their stratagems did not prevail. The Federals, forcefully led by Robert A. Bix, then head of the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice, succeeded in exposing them, with considerable help from some of the conspirators themselves, who, after an employee of a small conspirator company saw fit to spill the story in the early fall of 1959, flocked to turn state's evidence. The economic and social significance of the whole affair may be demonstrated clearly enough by citing just a few figures. In an average year at the time of the conspiracies, a total of more than $1.75 billion was spent to purchase machines of the sort in question, nearly a fourth of it by federal, state, and local governments, which of course means the taxpayers, and most of the rest by private utility companies, which are inclined to pass along any rise in the cost of their equipment to the public in the form of rate increases. To take a specific example of the kind of money involved in an individual transaction, the list price of a 500,000-kilowatt turbine generator, a monstrous device for producing electric power from steam power, was often something like $16 million. Actually, manufacturers sometimes cut their prices by as much as 25% in order to make a sale, and therefore, if everything was above board, it might have been possible to buy the machine at a saving of $4 million, if representatives of the companies making such generators held a single meeting and agreed to fix prices. They could, in effect, increase the cost to the customer by the $4 million. And in the end, the customer was almost sure to be the public. In presenting the indictments in Philadelphia, Bix stated that, considered collectively, they revealed a pattern of violations which can fairly be said to range among the most serious, the most flagrant, the most pervasive that have ever marked any basic American industry. Just before imposing the sentences, Judge J. Cullen Ganey went even further. In his view, the violations constituted a shocking indictment of a vast section of our economy. For what is really at stake here is the survival of the free enterprise system. The prison sentences showed that he meant it, although there had been many successful prosecutions for violation of the Sherman Act during the 7 decades since its passage. It was rare indeed for executives to be jailed. Not surprisingly, therefore, the case kicked up quite a ruckus in the press. The New Republic, to be sure, complained that the newspapers and magazines were intentionally playing down the biggest business scandal in decades. But the charge did not seem to have much foundation, considering such things as the public's apathy toward switchgear, the woeful bloodlessness of criminal cases involving antitrust laws, and the relatively few details of the conspiracies that had emerged. The press in general gave the story a good deal of space, and even the Wall Street Journal and Fortune ran uncompromising and highly informative accounts of the debacle. Here and there, in fact, one could detect signs of a revival of the spirit of old-time anti-business journalism, as it existed back in the 30s. After all, what could be more exhilarating than to see several dignified, impeccably tailored, and highly paid executives of a few of the nation's most respected corporations being trooped off to jail like common pickpockets. It was certainly the biggest moment for business baiters since 1938, when Richard Whitney, the former president of the New York Stock Exchange, was put behind bars for speculating with his customers' money. Some called it the biggest since Teapot Dome. To top it all off, there was a prevalent suspicion of hypocrisy in the very highest places. Neither the chairman of the board nor the president of General Electric, the largest of the corporate defendants, had been caught in the government's dragnet. And the same was true of Westinghouse Electric, the second largest. These four ultimate bosses let it be known that they had been entirely ignorant of what had been going on within their commands right up to the time the first testimony on the subject was given to the Justice Department. Many people, however, were not satisfied by these disclaimers, and instead took the position that the defendant executives were men in the middle, who had broken the law only in response either to actual orders or to a corporate climate favoring price fixing, and who are now being allowed to suffer for the sins of their superiors. Among the unsatisfied was Judge Ganey himself, who said at the time of the sentencing, "One would be most naive indeed to believe that these violations of the law, so long persisted in, affecting so large a segment of the industry, and finally involving so many millions upon millions of dollars, were facts unknown to those responsible for the conduct of the corporation. I am convinced that in the great number of these defendants' cases, they were torn between conscience and approved corporate policy, with the rewarding objectives of promotion, comfortable security, and large salaries." The public naturally wanted a ringleader, an arch conspirator, and it appeared to find what it wanted in General Electric, which, to the acute consternation of the men endeavoring to guide its destinies from company headquarters at 570 Lexington Avenue, New York City, got the lion's share of attention, both in the press and in the subcommittee hearings. With some 300,000 employees and sales averaging some $4 billion a year over the past 10 years, it was not only far and away the biggest of the 29 accused companies, but, judged on the basis of sales in 1959, the fifth biggest company in the country. It also drew a higher total of fines, $437,500, than any other company, and saw more of its executives sent to jail, three, with eight others receiving suspended sentences. Furthermore, as if to intensify in this hour of crisis the horror and shock of true believers and the glee of scoffers, its highest-ranking executives had for years tried to represent it to the public as a paragon of successful virtue by issuing encomiums to the free competitive system, the very system that the price-fixing meetings were set up to mock. In 1959, shortly after the government's investigation of the violations had been brought to the attention of GE's policymakers, the company demoted and cut the pay of those of its executives who admitted that they had been involved. One vice president, for example, was informed that instead of the $127,000 a year he had been getting, he would now get $40,000. He had scarcely adjusted himself to that blow when Judge Ganey fined him $4,000 and sent him to prison for 30 days. And shortly after he regained his freedom, General Electric eased him out entirely. The GE policy of imposing penalties of its own on these employees, regardless of what punishment the court might prescribe, was not adopted by Westinghouse, which waited until the judge had disposed of the case and then decided that the fines and prison sentences he had handed out to its stable of offenders were chastisement enough, and did not itself penalize them at all. Some people saw this attitude as evidence that Westinghouse was condoning the conspiracies, but others regarded it as a commendable if tacit admission that management at the highest level in the conniving companies was responsible, morally at least, for the whole mess, and was therefore in no position to discipline its erring employees. In the view of these people, GE's haste to penalize the acknowledged culprits on its payroll strongly suggested that the firm was trying to save its own skin by throwing a few luckless employees to the wolves, or, as Senator Philip A. Hart of Michigan put it more pungently during the hearings, to do a Pontius Pilate operation. Embattled days at 570 Lexington Avenue. After years of cloaking the company in the mantle of a wise and benevolent corporate institution, the public relations people at GE headquarters were faced with the ugly choice of representing its role in the price-fixing affair as that of either a fool or a knave. They tended strongly toward fool. Judge Ganey, by his statement that he assumed the conspiracies to have been not only condoned but approved by the top brass and the company as a whole, clearly chose knave. But his analysis may or may not have been the right one, and after reading the Kefauver subcommittee testimony, I have come to the melancholy conclusion that the truth will very likely never be known.
For, as the testimony shows, the clear waters of moral responsibility at GE became hopelessly muddied by a struggle to communicate. A struggle so confused that in some cases, it would appear, if one of the big bosses at GE had ordered a subordinate to break the law, the message would somehow have been garbled in its reception. And if the subordinate had informed the boss that he was holding conspiratorial meetings with competitors, the boss might well have been under the impression that the subordinate was gossiping idly about lawn parties or pinochle sessions. Specifically, it would appear that a subordinate who received a direct oral order from his boss had to figure out whether it meant what it seemed to or the exact opposite, while the boss, in conversing with a subordinate, had to figure out whether he should take what the man told him at face value or should attempt to translate it out of a secret code, to which he was by no means sure he had the key. That was the problem in a nutshell, and I state it here thus baldly, as a suggestion for any potential beneficiary of a foundation who may be casting about for a suitable project on which to draw up a prospectus. For the past 8 years or so, GE had had a company rule called Directive Policy 20.5. which read in part, "No employee shall enter into any understanding, agreement, plan, or scheme expressed or implied, formal or informal, with any competitor in regard to prices, terms, or conditions of sale, production, distribution, territories, or customers, nor exchange or discuss with a competitor prices, terms, or conditions of sale, or any other competitive information." In effect, this rule was simply an injunction to GE's personnel to obey the federal antitrust laws, except that it was somewhat more concrete and comprehensive in the matter of price than they are. It was almost impossible for executives with jurisdiction over pricing policies at GE to be unaware of 20.5, or even hazy about it, because to make sure that new executives were acquainted with it, and to refresh the memories of old ones, the company formally reissued and distributed it at intervals, and all such executives were asked to sign their names to it as an earnest that they were currently complying with it and intended to keep on doing so. The trouble, at least during the period covered by the court action, and apparently for a long time before that as well, was that some people at GE, including some of those who regularly signed 20.5, simply did not believe that it was to be taken seriously. They assumed that 20.5 was mere window dressing, that it was on the books solely to provide legal protection for the company and for the higher-ups, that meeting illegally with competitors was recognized and accepted as standard practice within the company, and that often when a ranking executive ordered a subordinate executive to comply with 20.5, he was actually ordering him to violate it. Illogical as it might seem, this last assumption becomes comprehensible in light of the fact that, for a time, when some executives orally conveyed or reconveyed the order, they were apparently in the habit of accompanying it with an unmistakable wink,
In May of 1948, for example, there was a meeting of GE sales managers, during which the custom of winking was openly discussed. Robert Paxton, an upper-level GE executive, who later became the company's president, addressed the meeting and delivered the usual admonition about antitrust violations. Whereupon, William S. Ginn, then a sales executive in the Transformer Division under Paxton's authority, startled him by saying, "I didn't see you wink." Paxton replied firmly, "There was no wink. We mean it, and these are the orders." Asked by Senator Kefauver how long he had been aware that orders issued at GE were sometimes accompanied by winks, Paxton replied that he had first observed the practice way back in 1935, when his boss had given him an instruction along with a wink or its equivalent, and that when, sometime later, the significance of the gesture dawned on him, he had become so incensed that he had, with difficulty, restrained himself from jeopardizing his career by punching the boss in the nose. Paxton went on to say that his objections to the practice of winking had been so strong as to earn him a reputation in the company for being an anti-wink man, and that he, for his part, had never winked. Although Paxton would seem to have left little doubt as to how he intended his winkless order of 1948 to be interpreted, its meaning failed to get through to Ginn. For not long after it was issued, he went out and fixed prices to a fare-thee-well. Obviously, it takes more than one company to make a price-fixing agreement, but all the testimony tends to indicate that it was GE that generally set the pattern for the rest of the industry in such matters. 13 years later, Ginn, fresh from a few weeks in jail and fresh out of a $135,000-a-year job, appeared before the subcommittee to account for, among other things, his strange response to the winkless order. He had disregarded it, he said, because he had received a contrary order from two of his other superiors in the GE chain of command, Henry V.B. Urban and Francis Fairman. And in explaining why he had heeded their order rather than Paxton's, he introduced the fascinating concept of degrees of communication, another theme for a foundation grantee to get his teeth into. Urban and Fairman, Ginn said, had been more articulate, persuasive, and forceful in issuing their order than Paxton had been in issuing his. Fairman especially, Ginn stressed, had proved to be a great communicator.